today's Dharma Day, which is the celebration of the path of the Dharma, or the teaching of the Buddha, or the truth that one is trying to approach through Buddhist practice. And I've called this talk, which is on the Dhammapada, there are a few translations of the Dhammapada, Footsteps of Truth, Following the Trackless One. And Dhammapada means footsteps of truth, or footsteps of Dharma, so that's why I've given it that title. But I just wanted to start by telling you how I first encountered the Dhammapada, which I didn't realise at the time I had encountered it. So before I got into Buddhism, though I don't know if you ever get this, but there are just one or two little prefigurings of something that would become very, very important to me later. One of them was that my father was in a junk shop on Portobello Road and saw a bronze Burmese Buddha, which he bought. So it was always had pride of place in his room. When I, as my parents separated, when I used to go down and see him when I was a teenager, the Buddha, very, very beautiful Buddha, which I've still got, was sitting there. And the other thing that I can remember was coming across somewhere a little book, which is this one, called The Gospel According to Zen. And the thing that is called The Gospel According to Zen, and it was published in the 1960s, and it's actually just a lot of, it's not just stuff from Zen, it's stuff that people thought, or the compilers thought, had a sort of a Zen flavour to it, from all sorts of traditions, including Christianity and Taoism and all sorts of things. But one section it has in there is, it just says, all it says is the Zen Rin. And it's a collection of little sayings. And these sayings, I actually copied them out into a little notebook, again, long before I got interested in Buddhism, and used to read them, because they just really, some of them really struck me. I'm not going to read them all out, but the one that particularly stuck in my mind was this one. There is no place to seek the mind. It is like the footprints of the birds in the sky. There is no place to seek the mind. It is like the footprints of the birds in the sky. And I suppose I had a response to poetic imagery, and that sense of the footprints of the birds in the sky, that sort of, in that paradox, because after all, the birds don't leave any footprints in the sky, do they? I mean, when a jet plane flies across the sky, it does leave a footprint. You see the vapor trail, but when a little group of geese cross the sky, they are there. They are in complete freedom. I mean, I suppose it's one of the things that's what they represent for us human beings somehow, a flying bird, at least for me. I don't know if you ever used to have these flying dreams where you had a dream where you could actually had the freedom just to sort of effortlessly across the sky. You know, it's just such an incredible feeling. And to have the sense of what it would be like to be able, like a swan, just to be able to cross the sky. And not just that freedom of crossing the sky, but leaving no track. And this was what really struck me about this saying. There's no place to seek the mind. It's like the footprints of the birds in the sky. Now, one could say a lot more about it, trying to explore it. In fact, Marissa was saying, well, why should one want to seek the mind? You know, and what is the mind anyway? What does that mean? There's no place to seek the mind. But let's just say for now, I may come back to this later because it's a very significant aspect of the Dhammapada, but for now let's just say that the mind means our actual experience of being alive. So yeah, so it means our what is actually happening for us. And so people will say, well, where is this experience? Can you find it? You know, can you show it to me? And this is quite a big theme in the book I published last year called Finding the Mind, the idea of finding the mind. Where can you find the mind? And I think this is the echo of it was still there many, many years later when I decided to write that book and realised that many branches of Buddhism ask this question, this paradox, that here is our experience, but where is this here? You know, and people sometimes want to tie it down. They want it to be inside your head or something like that. But can you seek it? Can you find it? And then for the saying to say, it's like the footsteps of the birds in the sky. in a way, that's just the kind of answer you want, in a way. It doesn't really answer the question. It doesn't tell you, but it shows that, is there a trace? Is there a track? That the mind, maybe there is, actually, and I'll come back to this. Now, the thing that really surprised me, I think, much, much later on, when I did get involved with Buddhism, was to discover that this comes from the Dhammapada. Mm-hmm. Now, it's actually a saying from a collection called the Zen Rin. And this is a collection of Chinese Buddhist sayings. And only a few of them are in here, just a few pages of them. But the complete collection is here. And the word Zen Rin, I believe, means Zen forest. Mm-hmm. The Zen forest. So it's as if you're walking through the forest of Zen, of the Dharma, of Buddhism, and you keep encountering trees and flowers and birds and nests and the sky breaking through. And there are these tiny, many of them very tiny little sayings, hundreds and hundreds of them, some of them completely baffling, some of them very beautiful, some of them contradicting each other, all sorts of sayings from many, many sources. And as I say, I was quite surprised because I think that most people, some people even think that Zen is one thing and Buddhism is another thing. We even get that nowadays, or a Zen, maybe they'll realise, well, it's a Zen Buddhist, but a Zen Buddhist is a kind of Buddhist that is completely different from a normal Buddhist. But gradually, I realised as I explored it that this is not actually the case, that Zen is genuine, as it were, Buddhism, if that matters to say that. But it is, in other words, the spirit of Chinese and Japanese channel Zen Buddhism is the same as the spirit of ordinary Buddhism. And of course, it has its own specialities. It very, very strongly stresses mindfulness and meditation, but then so do most kinds of Buddhism. It can be very simple. It has a special aesthetic and all that kind of thing. But I'm not going to go into what Zen means. But there you find this saying from a Japanese collection of Chinese sayings. And then you find it goes back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before that collection was made to India, northeast India, to a saying of the Buddha himself. Now, the saying from the Dhammapada is clearly changed as it's moved, this saying. And so I'll read it out to you. Before I do that, by the way, I'll just give you another translation of this saying, just to show you that, of course, when you're trying to translate something from another language, you can never do it perfectly. And if it's something very pithy and poetic and beautiful and so on, then there's a huge amount of leeway when you try and translate it. And in a way, as Dr. Johnson said, you have to read it and find out whether it's still a poem in English. That's the mark of a successful translation. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's an accurate translation. So here's the other one. It simply says, this is the one from this book. It says, where to seek? ? Birds print their tracks in the air. Full stop.
Did they say that mine has like a different meaning?
Well, I might go into that a little bit later about the meaning of mind, but just to mention that, you see, the mind is not even mentioned in that translation. Mm-hmm. It simply says, where to seek. That's all it says. Where to seek.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know Chinese, so I don't know why there is that difference between the two translations, but it simply says, where to seek, ? And then birds print their tracks in the air.
Yeah,
yes. Sorry. But then we look at the Dhammapada, and it's actually a longer thing in the Dhammapada, but I've sort of condensed it down. In verse 92 of the Dhammapada, it says, those whose pasture is liberation, their path, like that of birds in the sky, is difficult to trace. So you can see it is the same thing, isn't it? But the difference here is that instead of it being the mind, or just seeking, it's simply those whose pasture is liberation, their path is like that of the birds in the sky. So there's been a bit of a change from those whose pasture is liberation, in other words, those who have liberated themselves from all the things that sort of tie you, that lock you in, that confine you, that oppress you in life. Those, if you meet someone like that, then their path is like that of birds in the sky, difficult to trace. So in a way it's sort of setting it up as an ideal that eventually if you can gradually become freer and freer and freer, then in a way nobody can tie you down at all. And so that's the image of a person, rather than talking about experience in general or the fact of seeking. And just to complete that little introduction to the thing, I just want to mention another verse from the Dhammapada, and there are quite a few along these lines. I'll just read it out and then say something about it, because this is about the same area. It says, "That enlightened one, whose sphere is endless, whose victory is irreversible, and after whose victory no defilements remain to be conquered, by what track will you lead him astray, the trackless one? By what track will you lead him astray, the trackless one?" So again, here we have specifically the Buddha or the enlightened one. The you know, any Buddha is a trackless one, leaves no track. I just want to leave that in our mind a bit, what that could possibly convey, the sense of not leaving a track. Is that even a good thing, necessarily? Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, but certainly we often leave a track behind us, I think. And sometimes it can be the kind of track that we rather regret having left behind us, you know. And, you know, as a species, we are leaving a track behind us. You certainly couldn't say that the human race is trackless. It's leaving great tire marks over everything, really, isn't it, where it goes. And I do, somehow, that ideal, I suppose, of being trackless, it must have really sunk in. You know, when I first read this, I can't remember, about 18 or something, when I first came across it, and it was really what I aspired to. I was very, very into ecology and all that kind of thing in those days, and I just felt such a lot of regret at the negative impact that human beings were having, but as individuals as well as a species. Mm-hmm. And when I first encountered Buddhism, it really met my need to be incredibly inconspicuous. And so you can see a sort of a psychological element there, where the idea of being trackless, the idea of not leaving any trace at all, I thought, great, yes, I just want to be invisible. And that invisibility wasn't just to do with the, you know, not wanting to cause harm and being a pacifist and things like that. There was also something about, you know, shrinking into the shadows, you know, wanting not to be noticed, which was a psychological weakness, I think, on my part. And it took me a while to realise that actually that is not what Buddhism is about. Buddhism is not about shrinking into the shadows, being inconspicuous, not being... And even my voice went very, very quiet when I talked to people. They said, what are you saying? I can't hear you. And that was me sort of shrinking away into the shadows. I was even, you know, you get this with teenagers sometimes, I was sort of, my posture was going, like round shouldered. That was all part of the same thing. I don't know if that relates to anybody else's experience. So, we've got the idea of being trackless, the trackless one. But yet the Dhammapada, this word Dhammapada, means the footsteps of truth, or the tracks of truth, pada. Pada, in Pali, it's actually a very common word throughout all the Indo-European languages. So in Latin it becomes pedis, I think it is. So in English you get lots of words to do with pedals and pedometers and things, all to do with the foot. They're all to do with the foot, yeah. Probably other ones you can think of as well. So a pada means a foot, or a footstep. And it comes to mean a verse. It comes to mean a footstep in the sense that a verse of the truth, a dhammapada. The dhammapada means verses of truth, but it also, more literally, means footsteps of the dharma, footsteps of the path or the truth. So you, in a way, you've got the footsteps of the path. You've got the opposite image there, haven't you? And Buddhism has it right at its centre, this image of the path, a path to follow. I mean, if there were no tracks, if the Buddha didn't leave any tracks, how on earth are you going to follow his path? That is quite a problem, really, isn't it? You know, and how you can follow a track when there's no trace there. And that's worth pondering a little bit, I think, isn't it? I'm not necessarily going to solve this particular riddle, but it is quite interesting that the very work that's called The Footsteps of Truth contains a verse that talks about, or it's more than one verse, that talks about being like the bird in the sky, leaving no tracks, being the trackless one, as I've mentioned. So maybe the Dhammapada could be called the path to pathlessness, or the tracks to tracklessness. Maybe that would solve our conundrum in some way. So I'll just say a little bit about the Dharmapada. For those of you that aren't familiar with it, I expect probably everybody is, but I'll say it anyway. It's a collection of sayings of the Buddha. But it's a collection that was made very, very early. We don't know quite how early, but within 100 years of the Buddha's death, and was transmitted in oral tradition. And you'll find versions of it. It's literally a collection. It's not, in other words, it's not one teaching, or even a few teachings. It's almost every verse. Sometimes there are two or three verses that have come from one teaching, but they're almost from all sorts of places, these verses, from all sorts of places. Sometimes you will find them in other parts of the Buddha's teachings. Sometimes you only find them in the Pali Canon, in the Dhammapada. And the one that we're most familiar with is the one from the Pali Canon, and there are lots of translations of that, the Dhammapada from the Pali Canon. But you'll also find it in all the schools of Buddhism. So, for example, this one is the Tibetan version, and the Tibetan version comes from a Sanskrit version. There's another version of that there called the Tibetan Dhammapada. And so it's been very influential in Buddhism. It's been very, very popular. The different versions vary from each other, but they usually have a common core. So it's not that they call it the Dhammapada, but it's completely different collections of sayings. It's roughly the same collection, but the Tibetan one, for example, is much longer. I can't remember how much longer, but maybe something like 40% longer than the Pali one. So in other words, there are a lot more verses in there that you don't find in the Pali one, but nearly all the ones in the Pali one are in the Tibetan version. Then, of course, because it comes from different sources, you'll find interesting little discrepancies between them, and scholars have gone on and on and on and on and on about trying to understand these discrepancies and what it could all mean and what it could all say. And there's quite a nice article by a Buddhist monk and translator called Tanisara, where he says, well, to some extent, you're left with a feeling, oh, well, let's just not bother. You can't even tell what the Dhammapada originally was, so let's not bother. And he points out, no, it's not like that. That's not the way an oral tradition, because after all these things were memorized orally for hundreds of years, that's not the way it works. People will have their own versions. Mm-hmm. They'll have particular things they memorize, and particular mistakes may come in as well, in the same way as folk songs are like this. You know, the fact that you find so many different versions of a folk song doesn't mean that it's not worth singing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have a message, or maybe several messages. And the same goes for the Dhammapada. There are many versions, but they all do have a lot in common, which I hope I'll come into. Not that I'm a scholar of it, not that I've only read the Tibetan and the Pali versions, I should say. So it's a collection of the sayings. It's compiled after the Buddha's death, very popular. And what I thought I'd start off by doing here is to read out the headings of the chapters, because at least in the Pali, in the other versions as well, it's divided into chapters, and each chapter has a particular theme. And in the Pali there are 26 of them, so I'll just read them out. So the first one is called Pairs, Mindfulness, The Mind, Flowers, The Spiritually Immature, The Spiritually Mature, The Supremely Worthy, The Thousands, Evil, Punishment, Decay, Self and the World. Those are all separate chapters. The Enlightened One, Happiness, Affections, Anger, Stains, The Man of Principle, The Way, The Miscellaneous. Do we need a miscellaneous? The Woeful State, The Elephant, Craving, The Almsman, or the Bhikkhu, the almsman, in other words, what we usually call a monk, but the one who goes around reliant on gifts from the laity of food. And then finally, the Brahmana, or the Brahmin. So those are the names of the verses, chapters, I mean. And the thing is basically in poetry. It's in very beautiful Pali verse. It just sounds lovely. And it makes it more difficult to translate. It's one reason there are so many translations, because it's very terse and poetic. You can have all sorts of different versions. So, for example, if you picked up this one, which is one of the most popular by Thomas Byron, and you compared it to, say, the one by Sangharakshita, one of the other ones that are very literal, you might well think, is this really the same thing? It's so incredibly interpretive. I think it's very beautiful, actually, some of it. And I was thinking, having read Tanisara's piece, At first I sort of felt a bit dismissive of Thomas Byron's version, and also for a similar reason of the Penguin one, which is the one you're most likely to see, which is by Juan Mascaro, who's a Jesuit. So his Jesuitical ideas creep into it very strongly, and Thomas Byron's, you might say, New Age ideas creep into it very strongly, but yet, somehow, they have something, you know. I mean, one shouldn't say, I think the danger is to say, oh, the Buddha said, and read out something in here, because he didn't actually, he didn't. Mm-hmm. Thomas Byron said it, but it was inspired by the Dhammapada, and I think it is beautiful, very beautiful, some of that itself. So just to give you an idea, apparently we've got a little tradition now here of people singing in these talks. Somebody did this last Tuesday. So I'm going to...
Wednesday, was it?
Yes, Vandana Jyoti was here, who is a singer. I'm not a singer, but I will sing this bit out, because it is a section of Dhammapada that is often sung. And I just want... It may give you an idea of the beauty of the Pali, of the language in the Pali. I'll do my best anyway. Sabha papa sa akaranam kusalasa upasampada sachita pariyodapanam etang buddhana sasanam. So that, you'd like to know that's all I'm going to sing, but just to give you a sense of the rhythm, the beautiful rhythm of the verse. Really lovely. Sabha papa sa akaranam kusalasa upasampada sachita pariyodapanam etang buddhana sasanam. And this means cease to do evil, undertake what is skillful, purify your heart. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. Cease to do evil. Cease to do all evil, actually, literally. Cease to do all evil. Undertake what is skillful. Purify your heart. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. So some of the verses are like that. They're just very simple teachings like that. And in fact, there's a famous story about this verse, which... refers to, and this goes back to China as well, actually, of course. I forgot about this now, but of course this also shows this verse was popular in China. And there was a monk in China who's known as Bird's Nest. The reason he was known as Bird's Nest, because he'd always meditate up a tree. So he was sitting up this tree, you know, and he became, like sometimes happens with these very eccentric meditators, he became quite famous. And the governor of the province, like a really, really major guy, came to see him. So the governor of the province, who rather fancied himself as liking poetry and all that kind of thing, and he was a Taoist, and he came to see him, and he said, oh, this Buddhism business there, you know, what's it all about? What is Buddhism about? And the monk sort of came out of his meditation. He just sung this to him, you know, mm-hmm. in Chinese. And what do you mean? You know, he said, cease thee and undertake what is skillful, purify your heart. So a child of four could understand that. Mm-hmm. And of course, what Bird's Nest says in response is, well, yes, a child of four can understand this, but an old man your age finds it almost impossible to put it into practice. Mm-hmm. And I think, in a way, this is very important little saying this. This is a succinct summary of the whole of Buddhism. And in a way, this is not just Bird's Nest who thought this. He didn't just think, oh, I like that one from the Dhammapada, I'll recite that one too. Actually, no, traditionally speaking, this is a succinct... And the fact it actually says, etang buddhana sasanam, this is the dispensation, sasana, of the Buddhas, has a very strong force to it in saying that. This, in brief, is what Buddhism is about. And sometimes it's allied to the threefold path of ethics, meditation, wisdom. First of all, cease to do evil. In other words, stop causing trouble. Stop causing harm. And in a way, that was the little insight I had very early in my life. I just thought, I just want to be harmless. I don't want to cause problems, you know. So if I can be almost invisible, then maybe that'll work. But then that's not enough. Because then you have kusalasa upasampada. Undertake, take upon yourself that which is skillful. In other words, start bringing benefit to people. So cease doing harm is the ethics side of it, but then taking up the skillful means generating skillful mental states. It's not enough to follow a set of rules, you've got to follow them from your heart, from deep. So therefore, you need to take up skillful mental states and act from them. So that's the meditation phase. And then purify the heart is said to be the wisdom phase. So this is where gradually your mind becomes more and more free, more and more like the sky across which the geese can fly, more and more open in that way. Purify the heart, satchitta. In fact, satchitta means your own heart or your deep heart or your deep mind. So this would be memorised. You'd memorise this like Bird's Nest did. So if any passing governors come along and ask you what Buddhism is, you can just recite it.
Yeah, yes. Sing this verse.
You just sing it to them. Sabha papa sabha.
Well, you can look for my paper and we'll sing to you.
Yes. So the next thing I want to talk... I'm going to start talking about some of the things you'll find in the Dhammapada. And of course, really, there's no... There's no alternative to sitting down and actually reading it and finding things that work for you in there that are useful for you. And I hope that by having a day on it here, you know, parts of it may spark something off. Other parts you think, oh, no, that doesn't really mean anything to me. Oh, I don't like that bit, you know. But some parts may work for you. So I want to start off, I'm trying to jump right in the middle with verse 188, which is also a very, very strong sort of summary of what it means to be a Buddhist, what it means to be in Buddhism. And this is the way it starts. It says, many people, out of fear, flee for refuge to sacred hills and woods, groves and trees, or shrines. In reality, this is not a safe refuge. In reality, this is not the best refuge. Fleeing to such a refuge, one is not released from all suffering. He who goes for refuge to the enlightened one, to the truth, and to the spiritual community, and who sees with perfect wisdom the four Aryan truths, the four noble truths, namely suffering, the origin of suffering, the passing beyond suffering, and the Arya, the Noble Eightfold Way, leading to the pacification of suffering, for him this is a safe refuge. For him this is the best refuge. Having gone to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. So did you get that? Did that? In fact, maybe I've got a handout with all these on. I'm a little bit wary of handing it out because you may be tempted just to read the whole thing and not listen to what I'm saying. But if you promise just to look at the bit I'm talking about at the time, then it's just one sheet. At least it means you can sort of just ponder over it a bit if you want to, rather than me having to read it out more than once. So if you look down until you find the number 188, you'll find where we are. So I do want to go back, as a bit of a framework, in a short time, I want to go back to the Four Noble Truths. And look at the way the Dhammapada deals with those Four Noble Truths. Remember the Four Noble Truths, the first one is dukkha, sometimes translated as suffering, unsatisfactoriness, frustration. I like the word lack for dukkha, the sense of something being missing, something being wrong, you know. And sometimes Buddhists, of course, are accused of being pessimistic. They say, why are you going on and on about things being wrong, you know. But it does seem to me that, for most of us, things are not perfect. There is something wrong. There's something in life that niggles, you know. And probably if it wasn't, we wouldn't get into doing meditation and that kind of thing. So I think actually it's fair enough to start from that point and just face it, face what is wrong. And then it says, there's the second noble truth is the cause. So the cause is particularly is craving or thirst. So it's said that why is there dukkha? Why is there something wrong? It's because we're constantly grasping, we're constantly reaching for things that won't provide ultimate satisfaction. Maybe like those false refuges, you know, it says people go to sacred trees or to shrines or to holy places or maybe to all sorts of other things nowadays. You could add to that list, couldn't you, to shopping malls, to the television, you know, to food and so on. You could add to that list of refuges. This is not a safe refuge. This is not the best refuge. If you go to that refuge, it will not take you to the end of dukkha, the end of suffering. But if you can see, face up to that fact, that there is craving as the cause of dukkha, that can really be very helpful. And in fact, when the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, he just didn't just say, these four things are true. You know, suffering, the origin of suffering, da, 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 da. He didn't put it that way. He actually put it like this. He said, become aware of dukkha. Notice dukkha. Notice suffering. That's the first thing. So each one of them you have to act. The second one, he said, eradicate the cause. Deal with it. Deal with that issue of craving. Eradicate it. And then he said, realize the ending of dukkha. The quenching of dukkha, it says. What does it say here? The passing beyond suffering. So realize that. And then finally, practice or cultivate the path that takes you there. So those are the four actions you need to do. Be mindful, be aware of what's wrong, deal with the cause of what's wrong, and then realize the ending of suffering and cultivate the path that takes you there. So I'll say more about that later, about going into each of those, using Dhammapada verses. I just want to say a little bit before that about some of the other things that are in the Dhammapada. I mean, it's a set of aphorisms. And even those chapter headings, in a way, they're a little bit sort of boxes. It's almost like they had lots of slips of paper with all the Buddha's sayings on them. They think, oh, what book should we put this one on? Oh, it mentions the mind. We'll put it in the one called Another Mind. Or, oh, what's this? Yeah, well, but this is craving. So we'll put it in the one called craving. So it's not really that they've been put together. At least I don't think. Maybe Yashobodhi might disagree with them, or somebody else might disagree with them. They might have seen a really strong organising principle behind it. But my impression is it's a little bit jumbled. Mm-hmm. And so there is something in common between the verses, but they often come from all sorts of different directions. They don't necessarily, and they may even contradict each other to some extent. And they've just been put in these boxes, like slips of paper that have gone in. So it's a set of these aphorisms. It doesn't give you step-by-step instructions in general. It doesn't give you details of specific practice. You won't find, if you want to know how to do the mindfulness of breathing or the metta bhavana, you won't find that in the Dhammapada. You'll just find these very brief sayings. And the sayings are there to inspire you, there to warn you, there to admonish you, to encourage you in a particular direction, maybe to give you a vivid image to hold in your mind. It helps you to see what life is like, what life is like. Particularly it helps you to see what the human mind is like. And here's another one of the ones that I really love from the Dhammapada, which I quote in my book on the mind. Far-ranging is the mind. This is number 37. Far-ranging is the mind, and it walks alone. It's not material. It sleeps in the cave of your heart. Keep it controlled, and you're free from the bonds of death. Keep it controlled, and you're free from the bonds of death. And there is a lot in this, in the Dhammapada, about learning how to tame the mind, as they put it. I mentioned the chapter on the elephant. Now, what is the chapter on the elephant? The chapter on the elephant is how to have a pet elephant, basically. In other words, it's how to have the elephant sort of happy to follow the rider. And there's also mentioned in there the horse as well, riding the horse as well to make sure that the horse, its energy is all used in a really beneficial, constructive sort of way. Not the best metaphor for everybody. I mean, some people don't want to do too much taming of their elephants and horses. Mm-hmm. Maybe they want to let their elephants and horses really run wild for a while, because sometimes we do it too much, don't we? But I think in the Buddha's time, really, people were quite happy to run wild. That was no problem at all. What they needed was a little bit more discipline, a little bit more focus. And the Dhammapada does encourage this quite a lot. So keep the mind controlled and you're free from the bonds of death. And this is another one of those paradoxes in there. It talks about the mindful are free of the bonds of death. The mindful have found the deathless. But the unmindful are as if they're already dead. This is one of the very first verse, I think, in the section of mindfulness. The mindful are as if they're already dead. But if you're mindful, you have found the deathless. What can that mean? It doesn't mean that you live forever. I mean, the Buddha didn't live forever, and presumably he was fairly mindful. So it obviously doesn't mean that. So one has to try and work out, what does it mean to escape from the bonds of death? What does it mean to have found the deathless? And we'll have some chance to chat about it afterwards, so you can ask me that. I haven't actually put that one in the handout, unfortunately, but so you'll have to remember that one. So it's the mind that is the key to human experience, or it is the mind which is human experience, really. That's what we're talking about, is human experience, what experience is like. And so the very beginning, verses 1 and 2 of the Dhammapada, express this. And I think in this case, there's no accident that they're the first verses. I think they were chosen very deliberately to open the whole thing. So experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows, like a shadow that never departs. So that goes a little bit further, doesn't it, than the one that says, cease to do evil, undertake the skillful. It says that if you don't cease to do evil, it's as if you are like an ox pulling along this huge load, this huge cart, and it'll follow you all the time. This burden, it's a burden. Being unskillful, being causing problems to other people, all that kind of thing, and to oneself, it just is a burden. It's a really difficult burden. It's as if you were this poor ox having to pull along this really huge heavy cart with wooden wheels along the rutted, muddy roads of the Indian monsoon season. But if you speak or act with a pure mind, happiness follows like the shadow which never departs. And there's a lovely difference between those images, isn't there? The image of the ox is so heavy, it's such a burden. The image of a shadow, it just completely, you couldn't imagine anything lighter, anything that's less of a burden than the shadow. It just, if you imagine that happiness is with you, just like your shadow, you're in the sunshine, you're in the light of wisdom, and there is the happiness. Sometimes it's long, sometimes it's short, but you don't have to sort of, come on shadow, you know, don't stay behind, you know, we're off now. It'll always stay with you. Yeah. So I find that very encouraging little image. And the Buddha's come up with it. I think that whoever compiled the Dhammapada obviously loved some of these really vivid images that the Buddha used and really wanted to get some of them in there. So remember that the Dhammapada is a little bit of a jumble. It's compiled from all sorts of teaching incidents that the Buddha was involved with. Sometimes they even tell you the story as to when he gave this particular teaching. And it means that the different teachings were addressed to all sorts of people, young and old, men and women, good and bad, you know, rich and poor, addressed to those who were full-time Buddhists who decided to go for it, you know, and become nuns or monks or the equivalent, and also addressed to people who were very busy, you know, looking after their families, looking after their businesses, looking after political affairs. So there's a huge range of audiences. Lots of different circumstances, lots of different purposes. And very broadly, as I went through it, I noticed maybe four contexts in the verses four. It may not be completely comprehensive, this, but four broad contexts. Some of them are very simple advice on how to lead an effective and ethical life. A life in which you communicate kindly, you develop good relationships with other people, you find a happy contentment in your life. Which is, imagine, that'd be fantastic, wouldn't it, if you could do that, you know. So in a way, they're a little bit like the wisdom sayings you'll get from all tradition. They're just saying, look, you know, look out for people, you know, don't talk harshly, don't steal things, don't sleep with your neighbour's wife or husband, all that kind of straightforward ethical teaching to do with just living well in the world, yeah. There's quite a lot like that, which is really useful, actually. I'll just give you one example here. All living beings are terrified of punishment. All fear death. To all, life is dear. Making comparison of others with oneself, one should neither kill nor cause to kill. So you've got not just thou shalt not kill, but also a little bit more, what's called the golden rule, I think, in Greek philosophy, isn't it? You know, this thing of, well, just think about how you would feel. Realise that yes, you're not the only one that is scared of violence, scared of pain and so on, scared of dying. Others are as well. If you eat animals, they don't want to die, you know. If you're unkind to your nephew, you don't want somebody being unkind. You've got to sort of... So anyway, it's fairly obvious, but it's still worth saying, that kind of thing, isn't it? But then some of the verses go further than this, you know, how to live effectively socially with other people and get on with people and so on. In a way, they're more what you might call the religious ones. They're more about the spiritual life. They're about achieving a deep tranquility of mind that has a great endurance, that has a great staying power to it. So it's very solid. In other words, traditionally, a skillful state of mind that will last beyond death. So this is the kind of thing where it warns you about, you know, how are you going to die? What kind of a death are you going to have? And what will your future life be like? Because, of course, it was taken for granted that you would, unless you're enlightened, you would have to face another life. And how you live now affects how you will be there. And through working on your mind, you can achieve a sense of ease, a lack of fear about the future, about your own future, maybe even just the future in this life, but maybe thinking in those religious terms about a future life. So there are some verses that are doing that. But of course, as you probably know, Buddhism doesn't regard this kind of spiritual or religious virtuousness as being the ultimate goal. That's not what Buddhism is about. It's not that there's anything wrong with it, but it's not actually complete. It's not a true refuge. It's not a reliable refuge, because you will tend to go round in circles. You may be able to achieve virtuousness for a while, but unless it's actually a total transformation of your own character, which is imbued by complete insight, by wisdom about what's going on, then it won't persist. And you'll be on the wheel of life. You may be at the top of the wheel of life for a while, it's all very nice up there, but you'll soon find yourself slipping down again. So your happiness at this stage is caught up in the duality of good or bad, right or wrong. It's not yet liberated. So instead, you seek fullness of wisdom, fullness of compassion, which is enlightenment, something that transcends religious virtue, that frees you from the cycle, from the wheel of life, the cycle of birth and death altogether, transcending suffering completely. So some of the verses I've already quoted are about this dimension, the specifically, as at least as Buddhists would say, specifically Buddhist dimension of complete liberation from the very cycle. So I'm going to go back to the Four Noble Truths before I finish, and I've concentrated mainly on that third type because that's what interests me most. I mean, it's easy to skip over the other two types sometimes and just think, oh, well, that's obvious, isn't it? Yes, you know, don't go off with somebody else's girlfriend. Well, obviously don't, you know, but I think, in a way, it's worth not skipping over them and saying, well, actually, let me reflect on my own self in the light of this kind of suggestion and see what I think about it. But I've concentrated on the third type, on the transcendental type. The first two, the one about leading a good life, on the one hand, and the more religious type, they seem to be directed at those inspired by Buddhism, but still leading a normal standard life, in a way, with its priorities of raising a family, priority of personal status and career and so on, and the priority of material prosperity, you know, so that you can look after your family properly, you know, the normal life. And in that case, the Buddha didn't neglect people like that. He said, well, you know, if that's the life you're leading, this is what I suggest. Have a look at this, have a look at this, have a look at this. But the third type is maybe more for what you might call full-timers. And I don't mean by full-timers necessarily people who have shaved their heads and given everything away, but I mean people for whom they want to make the Dharma itself the priority in all circumstances, and we might want to talk about this a bit more later, made a commitment to following the path, the overriding priority in their lives. So family, status, prosperity, they may still be elements in life, but the priority, that is the refuge, is this trackless way, flying on into the sky, into the open, into the trackless way. And there is a fourth category which you'll find in there, maybe as an encouragement to following this radical path. You've got simply extolling the qualities and the virtues of those who are enlightened or those who have insight. So you remember there's a section of the enlightened one, for example, a section of the supremely worthy one. They actually just describe what people like that are like. As an encouragement. You know, you may think, oh God, I don't know, I'm not going to quite manage that, but it's supposed to be an encouragement to say, you know, this is what such people are like. And also it's saying, if you find people who are at least a little bit like that, it's worth paying attention to them and spending some time with them and listening to them. So those are the four areas you can look out for, whether you're going for a good life or for religious practice or for complete awakening. And also praising the qualities of the enlightened. Some verses go further than others. Some incorporate all three. It's not quite as neat as I've implied. So from what I'm going to do, just to finish, I think I'm going to just read out some verses around each of the Four Noble Truths. And I won't go into them at this stage. I'll just read them out so that you can think about them, and there may be some that you want to ask questions about or comment on. So first of all, remember, what's the first noble truth is not just dukkha, not just frustration or unsatisfactoriness, but it's become aware of dukkha, notice dukkha. So, there is no fire like lust, there is no blemish like demerit, there's no suffering like the taking up of the five constituents of conditioned existence. There's no happiness like peace. Hunger is the worst disease. Conditioned existence is the worst suffering. Knowing this as it really is, one realizes that nirvana is the highest happiness. And then I've chosen a different translation for this pair of verses, which is a very, very famous little saying from the Dhammapada, only found in the Dhammapada, interestingly, although it's so crucial. And it's said to be a poem that the Buddha composed immediately after his enlightenment as a response to his sense of freedom and what had happened. And it has this strong imagery. And I've chosen the translation by Edwin Arnold, which is from the 1860s, I think he made this translation, when he wrote a poetic version of the Buddha's life. It's not necessarily all that accurate, but there's something really resounding about it, I think. Many a house, this is the Buddha speaking, remember, many a house of life hath held me, seeking ever him who wrought these prisons of the senses, sorrow fraught. Sore was my ceaseless strife. But now, thou builder of this tabernacle, thou, I know thee, never shalt thou build again these walls of pain, nor raise the roof tree of deceits, nor lay fresh rafters on the clay. Broken thy house is, and thy ridge pole split. Delusion fashioned it. Safe pass I thence, deliverance to obtain. So that's the sort of the song of victory, or maybe the intention of victory, maybe from immediately before the enlightenment, because he says, I am leaving behind this house, this prison of the senses, this roof tree of deceit and so on. Okay, so that's on suffering. And now verses on the eradication of the cause of suffering, namely craving. From craving arises grief, from craving arises fear. For one who is wholly free from craving, there's no grief. And whence should fear come? Not even in a shower of money is satisfaction of desires to be found. Worldly pleasures are of little relish, indeed painful. Thus understanding, the spiritually mature person takes no delight even in heavenly pleasures. The disciple of the fully, perfectly enlightened one takes delight only in the destruction of craving. Whoever in the world overcomes this wretched, adhesive craving, so difficult to overcome, his sorrows fall from him like drops of water from the lotus leaf. Attended upon by craving, the race of men run about in terror like a trapped hare. Fettered and bound as they are, suffering befalls them again and again for a long time. The gift of the Dharma surpasses all gifts. The taste of the Dharma surpasses all tastes. Delight in the Dharma surpasses all delights. The destruction of craving overcomes all suffering. Cut off your sticky affection, as one plucks with one's hand the white autumnal lotus. Develop the way of peace, the nirvana taught by the happy one. And then the third noble truth, verses on realizing the quenching of dukkha, or the ending of dukkha. Happy is the appearance of the enlightened ones. A lot of these I've just chosen because they're talking about happiness, but the happiness that comes from liberation. Happy is the appearance of the enlightened ones. Happy is the teaching of the real truth. Happy is the unity of the spiritual community. Happy is the spiritual effort of the united. Happy indeed we live, friendly among the haters, among men who hate, we dwell free from hate. Happy indeed we live, healthy amid the sick, among men who are sick, we dwell free from sickness. Happy indeed we live, content amid the greedy, among men who are greedy, we dwell free from greed. Happy indeed we live, we, for whom there are no possessions, feeders on rapture shall we be, like the gods of brilliant light. For the almsman who enters an empty cottage, who is a peaceful mind, and who perfectly comprehends the Dharma, There is joy surpassing that of men. He is a superior man who does not merely believe, but who knows the unmade, who has severed all links with conditioned existence, put an end to the occasions of good and evil, and who has renounced all worldly hopes. And then a few verses on the path. I think Robbie might be doing the section on the path, is that right? Yes, so you'll hear more on the path. This may not be from the chapter on the path, I can't remember. Following this way, you will make an end of suffering. This indeed is the way proclaimed by me, ever since I knew how to draw out the darts of craving. By you must the zealous effort be made. The Tathagatas, the Buddhas, are only proclaimers of the way. Those who are absorbed in higher meditative states eventually win release from the bondage of Mara. And this last one is quite a refrain in the Dhammapada. It's always saying, look, no one can do this for you. Mm-hmm. If you want to do it, you've got to do it yourself. Mm-hmm. Something like the Dhammapada should be a finger pointing at the moon. It can show you, suggest, well, try this, you know, try that direction, try that attitude. But you've still got to do it. Mm-hmm. You can't just hear it. You can't just be in the presence of a guru or something. You've actually got to do it yourself. And then, almost finally, I just wanted to give you a few examples. I mentioned how rich the imagery in the Dhammapada is. So this, again, is a little miscellaneous collection of some of the images. You've already heard quite a few in what I've already said. Sandalwood or aromatic resin, blue lotus or wild jasmine. Of all these kinds of fragrance, the odour of virtue is unsurpassed. Insignificant in comparison is this fragrance of aromatic resin and sandalwood. The fragrance of virtue it is that blows among the gods of the highest. And another verse elsewhere says that the fragrance of leading a beneficial life, unlike incense, it goes against the wind. It spreads in all directions from you. It doesn't just blow along with the wind, it says, which is quite a nice thought. You are now like a withered leaf. Death's men have approached you. You stand at the door of departure, and you don't even have provisions for the road. It's a little warning one there. And then, make a lamp for yourself. Strive quickly and become one who is spiritually mature. Make a lamp for yourself. So it said the Dharma is the lamp. Elsewhere. And then, follow one who is wise, as the moon follows the path of the stars. So, what I suggest with the Dhammapada, if you do find it useful, have a look at it. Get yourself a copy of a translation that you like. And Priscilla's going to say something about different translations, I think, aren't she? I hope I didn't spoil it by mentioning Thomas Byron's in a way I did. Try to read the verses very slowly. Learn them by heart, if you like them. The ones that strike you, just learn it by heart. It's worth doing that. And let it go when you're cycling along or waiting for the tube. Let it go through your mind. In fact, Sangharakshita, who produced the translation that I've used for most of this talk, he actually learnt the whole Dhammapada in heart, in Pali, before he learnt Pali.
Yeah.
So he learnt it simply by rote. So although he knew a few of the words, because he was a very young man at the time, wandering in India, only about 20, I think, but he just decided, I'm just going to do this. And every day he learnt a verse until he learnt the whole of the Dhammapada. And he still knows it. He knows the whole thing in Pali by heart. And I'm sure that has influenced the translation. The verses have just been with him. So maybe that's going a bit far, but he maybe learned a few verses in English if you don't want to learn the whole Pali. Some of the verses you won't respond to. Some you won't understand, but some will strike you. They may stay with you. Ponder them. Just see what the implications are. Let them gradually release their flavour. Now, all sorts of animals turn up as metaphors and comparisons in the Dhammapada. I've mentioned the elephant, I've mentioned the horse. But for some reason, it's that image of the birds flying freely across the sky. That is the one that really grabbed me before I'd encountered anything else about Buddhism, as I say, when I just came across those verses of the Zenrin. And in the verse, I mentioned the verse from the Dhammapada, number 92, which is about the footprints of the bird in the sky, the one that the Zemrian verse is derived from. The one before that says this: the mindful who leave home do not delight in an abode. Like wild geese quitting a lake, they abandon whatever security they have. Okay, so I'll leave it there.